Garcia driving. Bill Lane crosses up. Van Vliet, okie doke move, and lays it up for two. Lee with a nifty move there.
He could go all the way, and the freshman takes it to the house with no time on the clock. Are you kidding me? He takes it 60 yards. Welcome to Redbird Nation.
And the shoe. She gets it to Katie Broadway. Broadway taking it herself down the left side. No good. But she's going to get on a rebound. Kicks it out. Kansas Sykes for three. No, it's good.
She got it.
Kansas Sykes for three.
From local high school action to the birds and the pros, with live interviews, reporting, debate, and discussion, WZND's Red Zone brings you all the sports you can handle each week. The Red Zone starts now, only on 103.3 WZND,
the pulse of Redbird Nation.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. This is the Red Zone on WZND. I'm Leo Stauder, your sports director and master of ceremonies.
Ooh.
I'm joined by my assistant sports director, Joey Dwyer, and he has started a petition to bring back the Burger King and Einstein bagels in the Bone Student Center.
Oh, I second that.
And I
especially
would,
the Einsteins.
Oh, the Einsteins? What are we doing? What are we doing? The Starbucks, it's overpriced. The bagels aren't as good.
Uh-huh.
What are we doing? Bring back the Einsteins.
You know they're probably playing this in the Bone Center.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm good.
That's
good.
Why we
I'm
need
glad.
To say this. So,
if
yeah.
you guys are listening the in Einstein. The Bone Student Center, bring back the Einsteins. I don't care about the Qdoba. I don't care about any of that stuff.
They're
I just want to get a good bagel. I know. I'm banned from the Bone now. Sorry about that, guys.
And our producer, Joe Kennedy, and if Coach would have put him in 82, we would have won state and things would have been a lot different.
That is true.
Guys, we got a loaded show
We
tonight.
Do got a lot of talk
We got
about.
A lot of Redbird sports to cover. We have an awesome interview with Redbird golfer Emma Sutton. Probably one of the favorites we've done this semester.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting perspective from her. Mm-hmm. And then Mikey Frenelli is going to talk to us about Redbird volleyball
Our
and
guy.
Some MLB action. So we're going to cover a lot of bases tonight. But let's start about it with a team we've been following intently the past couple weeks, the Redbird soccer team, because they had a hectic past couple days beating UNI in the quarterfinals and then losing ultimately to Loyola in the semis. Guys, where should we start with this?
Okay, so let's start with the UNI game first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was doing that call with former WZND sports director Andy Olson.
Who we had on, yep.
Shout out Andy.
Shout out Andy.
Hope he's recovering well.
I'll
got
go
his
Andy.
Deviated septum fixed, so hope he's doing all right. But that game was insane. Because for the entire game, really, it looked like ISU was the better team, but they just had a great goal. It was, I think it was Johnny Hill for UNI who scored just a super low percentage chance, but it was a great shot. Mm-hmm. And then ISU was winning in shots and shots on goal, but their only goal in regular time was own goal. And so that was insane. And then Priya Gillen stepped up crazy in the PKs.
Yeah.
The Redbirds won 3-0 in PKs, and it was absolutely terrific. I was shocked.
And that game was one where it felt like it was like a game we had seen a lot this season. It was
with the chances
off,
and everything
yeah, where
for
they
the
gave
offense,
up an early
yeah.
goal, even though they were out playing the other team and kind of fell apart after that. But they really overcame adversity in that game, responded well to that goal, and came back. And I was in the press conference with Coach Sylvie afterwards, and the question came up. This was the first year PKs have been allowed in the Valley postseason. So they asked, like, how many times do they practice? What do they do to prepare? And he says that they only practiced them once last week.
Once? I feel like
season.
That's like something you do at the end of every practice.
No,
like, I don't know, like a 5-minute thing.
He didn't want them
thing.
Thinking about it, getting their minds wrapped up in it. So they practice it once right before the conference tournament. And it worked because they made all three of their goals in PKs.
And with you and their goalkeeper was doing an amazing job that game, denying ISU on the offense. And then they took her out just for the more athletic goalie, too, as well. But, I mean,
it was the injury, though. Remember, she got ran into.
It did, but that she got out, yeah. she got she hit. Came. So, yeah, so Sarah Lafayette kicked her in the face. But that was, like, maybe the 47th minute, something like that.
Yeah.
And then she came right back into the game. And so she was in for the entire second half, both overtime periods. So they only took her out.
Oh, they put a different keeper in for PKs.
Just for PKs.
I didn't catch that. I was at the game.
And honestly, it was probably just because
the size?
Backup keeper was 6 foot.
Yeah.
So she had a little bit more size. But that was a decision that I didn't get at the time.
Yeah.
And I can kind of understand why you would want to go with the size, but you have a goalkeeper who's been hot all game.
And you have to think about it, too. That was a cold, rainy day. Like, the other keeper's been sitting on the bench all game, hasn't been warmed up, and has to go in the most high leverage situation of the match. That just seems like you're setting her up to fail.
Exactly. And so that was an awesome game. It was an awesome way for the Birds to move on in the tournament. And then they had to go face Loyola, who is undisputed the best team in the Valley. And the Birds actually hung in there, forced another overtime. So they got scored on early yet again.
Mm-hmm.
And then had to climb back, and throughout the entire second half, it really looked like they were gaining momentum slowly but surely.
Yeah, they could
and
score.
Then in the 84th minute, Riley O'Brien with the incredible header that she snuck right over the keeper, but they just couldn't keep it alive through OT. But even that Loyola game showed you that this team is for real, and with only one player leaving the team at the end of the year, I think they're in really good shape to contend for the Valley Championship next year.
Yeah, but Abby Basler, definitely arguably the best player on the team this year. Led the team in points with 4 goals, 3 assists this year. And it's going to be tough to replace her, but like Joey was saying, all throughout the year, I feel like there's still also a fair balance of players, younger, like freshmen and sophomores, that maybe only played about 9 games or so, but they were still able to get there, and they were still able to get that experience, and that's important, and especially the 2 games that they played in the conference play, because not every team gets to go to the conference tournament in Missouri Valley Soccer.
And the really nice thing about the way that the Birds are built right now is with Abby Basler departing in the midfield, they have a couple of really good midfielders who can take her spot. They've got Logan Ziegler, who's seen considerable minutes this
really
year.
Good too, I feel
and
like
Catherine Ashley, both of those players saw almost equivalent to starting minutes for the Birds at some points this season. So that is they're setting themselves up really nicely in that midfield to replace Basler with, and then Ashley Santos coming back for her 5th year with the extra year of eligibility. It really sets them up nicely in the midfield, and then we saw their defense has played very well all season. The only issue with the defense was number 18 on the Loyola Chicago team, Megan Nemec, and she might be the fastest person I've ever seen. It was ridiculous. The speed that she had on the outside, and Alyssa Ramsden and Michaela Christian are two of the best defenders in the Valley, and they were having trouble. Like, and that's what makes this Loyola team so good, is they can attack you with a variety of different skill sets, but this just happened to be all that speed on the outside from Nemec, and then Catherine Stevens was able to capitalize on that in the OT period. But it was
the final goal too was like, it was a little debate. It seemed like the first person hit it in. It seemed like the second person was offsides, almost like in the goal, who tapped it in the overtime period. But I guess I couldn't get a really good look at it too at first, but yeah, it was a heartbreaking way to lose, kind of just like that, right off the crossbar and everything.
And so coming into next season now, I think what the Birds really need to focus on is just not taking that loss of Abby Basler too hard, because we've seen that they have other players who can contribute. Sarah Lafayette had a really nice season. Ashley Santos, who we've talked about. Riley O'Brien. So some of these players have had really nice seasons offensively. So, and they have a lot of players who can step up and take more of that production role. So next season, I think it'll be fun to watch who are those players who step up into those more important roles as the season progresses, because the Birds need players who can score. They've got it figured out on the back end, and they don't have anybody leaving back there, so we'll see who they can get back to, who can put some balls in the back of the net.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be very exciting to see where this team goes. I know I had a blast. I got to cover 2 of their games for TV10 this semester, and I love the atmosphere there.
Exciting.
The teams are exciting. Coach Sylvie's a quote machine, so he's a lot of fun. But another
that, that man is electric in a press conference.
He always has his word of the week, and that's always fun to hear about. But another team that I've enjoyed covering this season welcomed a nationally ranked opponent to Duffy Bass Field this season. The ISU baseball team faced number 25 ranked Indiana State. And while they lost the series 3-1, I thought this was a big statement series for the Redbirds, because I was at the game on Saturday, Joe's birthday, where they did beat the Sycamores. And this was the first, I think, true one of the best complete games we've seen from this team all season. We saw Jordan Lucier throw seven scoreless innings, and then Derek Solotta came in, got the six-out save, but the offense was finally clicking at the rate we've kind of been waiting to see, where Hayden Jones was absolutely murdering the ball, Ryan Cermak was making great contact, and that carried them, because this team's been playing without Joe Butler, arguably their best player, for most of the month of April and even dating back to March. He's got a hand injury. And Gunnar Pedersen, one of their other more power hitters, has been hurt as well. So they've been overcoming some adversity as well.
And if you look at like the three of the games ISU could have probably kind of easily won. The one first game on Friday, they had a chance to win that game. The second game, I was here doing the studio host, and they kind of weren't in that one. Indiana State kind of got off to just a quick start, and in the middle of the inning, extended their lead. But also before that Indiana State series, they beat Southern Illinois, who's a 20-plus win team already into this year. So they've gotten some... They were on a roll heading into that series against Indiana State, and that's a top 25 team, like you said.
And you know, you look at it where they've had a very tough non-conference schedule, even with so many games canceled. I think they're very well positioned now to start contending as they face the bulk of their Valley schedule.
And in that Indiana State series, even that Sunday game, they forced it into extras, and Sean Sinisco. Is that how you say that last one? I think so. Sean Sinisco, he pitched almost eight innings, only gave up three runs, and pitched super well in 100 pitches.
That was the game they coughed up the 6-0 lead, which was a tough one.
And it's a heartbreaker. They just had some problems with the bullpen. But those are things that can be fixed over the course of the season. So I'm not too concerned about that series, especially against such a good team. And Leo, like you said, I think they're set up extremely well going into this Valley schedule, knowing that they're probably not going to see a team on the same caliber as Indiana State again for for the rest of the season.
Right, but I think the thing about this team that concerns me the most would be the bullpen, because they got good arms coming out of there, but they don't have much velocity, which the way now baseball is, where you want that velo coming out of the pen. I think their hardest throwing pitcher out of the bullpen is Derek Solotta, who's maxing out around 95, but they only have one other pitcher that touches the 90s as well. So I think that's something they're going to have to work around, that where you're not going to get that overpowering velocity, so you have to have good pitch sequencing and get some of those swinging and miss at bats more, because as the way these games go on, the players are anticipating the speed to increase as the game goes on, especially coming out of the pen. So I think that's where we've seen a couple of the blown leads out of the bullpen have happened, because they don't have much velocity coming out of there. But I think another thing is the bats have really been heating up. They had some players that were struggling to start the year, like the catcher from Missouri State, Mason Hayes, Hayden Jones.
Yeah, there we go.
he was kind of struggling to start the year, and he's really heated up this year, or this past series. I think you look at it, the Butler injury has allowed him to come in playing first base when he had been relegated to backup catcher, wasn't getting the reps he was used to seeing. But so now with the injury, he's been able to come in and step up and start to get more plate appearances, and is starting to finally find his groove, get his batting average above 200, which has been huge for the Redbirds, because they do have so many good depth bats.
Yeah, they do. It goes a long way back. And with that pitching, you got to start to ask your starting pitchers to go longer, because that bullpen, as you're saying, is a little struggling right now, but can be fixed also, like what Joey was saying. But it's going to be hard to ask for your starting pitchers to go longer, especially as the season started to come wind down, and you're going to be playing even more and more games too as well.
You know, interesting point that Andrew Avola made for me was, as opposed to college versus professional pitchers, where college pitchers, so Colton Johnson, he could go throw eight innings and then not pitch again for six more days.
Yeah.
It's different. Oh, I guess it's kind of similar for pros, but maybe you might only get a four-day layoff, or you can pitch twice in a week. Johnson, he might only pitch every Friday.
Yeah.
So he can go deeper into ball games and kind of get that rest to recover to be able to do that. But then you always hear about it where college coaches overwork their pitchers, and their arms are dead by the time they get to the pros. So it's kind of give and take with Coach Holm there.
But this Coach Holm is a pitcher's coach. Like when we talked to him, he was a former catcher. Definitely. He knows what his pitchers want. So I have no doubt that he's going to treat his pitchers like they need to be treated. And I think the schedule also lends itself very well to being able to space out your pitchers, because you're only playing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And so if you've got four pitchers, because you've got usually got that doubleheader on Saturday, if you've got four good starting pitchers who can give you 7-8 innings a game, you're set.
Yeah, because you really only
need two or three guys who are really solid in the bullpen who can close out these games for you. Because at the end of the day, you're pitching a guy once a week, like Leo said, and that's enough to get him once every four games.
And you want to keep him going deep, too, yeah.
Absolutely. So it's going to be fun to see where this team can go moving forward. We're going to have games coming up on WZND next weekend. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, though, we're going to have the interview with Emma Sutton, so stick around for that. You're listening to The Red Zone on 103.3 WZND, the pulse of Redbird Nation.
Hey, this is Dickie V, baby, and you're listening to The Red Zone, baby, only on 103.3 WZND.
Welcome back to The Red Zone. Leo Sauterher with Joey Dwyer and Joe Kennedy. We're now joined by Emma Sutton of the ISU golf team. And now Emma is from Adelaide, Australia. So first, I just want to ask, how did you end up getting from Australia to Normal, Illinois?
Yeah, I actually transferred after my freshman year. So I was at a school on the East Coast. And then I just kind of looked around and fell in love with the quad and ISU and the facilities. And yeah, it's a very big change from the city I'm from, but I really like Normal and the Midwest.
And how was the transition coming from your hometown all the way across the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, it was definitely hard at first. I did the walk down the plane aisle crying my eyes out after I said goodbye to my family. I was 17 at the time, and I was kind of just full of adventure, and I just wanted to see the world. So it's definitely been hard. I've had my ups and downs, especially with COVID now, but it's been wonderful.
And so how did you get recruited to come to the United States? Did you want to do that like all along, or did it kind of just come up?
It kind of just came up. A few people from Australia in like the golf scene went a little bit before me, and I kind of thought it'd be a really cool thing to do. I didn't really think about it until probably my junior year of high school. And then I just started sending a lot of emails to a lot of coaches, and yeah, I got recruited.
Is it been an adjustment playing golf in America as opposed to Australia? Are the terrains any kind of different, or has that been something you've been able to do seamlessly?
It was hard at first with different grasses. At home, I play on sandbelt courses, so they're very hard and firm. So here, that was a bit of an adjustment. And we also play longer here, being at college. It's always a jump up from high school. So that was one change as well.
And so looking at the golf season that you guys have put together, how confident do you feel heading into the tournament this weekend?
Confident without being too cocky, I think. We have a great team. We have so much potential, and I'm honestly so excited. It'd be awesome to get a ring, especially being a senior, and that I'm leaving. It'd be a great way to go out. But yeah, I have a lot of faith in this team, so I think we can get it done.
And you're talking about the team, and there's players all around the world on your guys' team. Can you talk about the diversity you guys have?
Yeah, I think we have four internationals, and then I think we only have two from Illinois. So then we've got all over, America as well. We have lots of different characters, which is wonderful at times and obviously difficult at times being a group of 10 girls. Everyone brings such unique qualities to the team, and we're really lucky.
So what's one area of your game you're working on the most this week in practice before the conference tournament?
Just trying to get my ball striking solid. It's really hard with the wind at the moment. It doesn't seem to stop here in Normal. But just trying to get my ball striking solid. I'm really confident with my putting, so I'm kind of just maintaining that. Trying to get my ball striking so I know I'm going to hit greens and I have the chances to make those birdies.
And what does an average practice or an average day at the course look like for you?
Yeah, so practice depends whether we stay on the practice green and like the range, or we go out on course. But typically we'll do three or four putting drills, then we'll do a few chipping, and then we'll go to the range and just work on swing mechanics and stuff like that. But yesterday, for example, we went out on course and practiced going in the trees and practicing our punch shots, because obviously it's inevitable we end up in the trees at some point. So we practice them. So it just depends.
And you were talking about the differences between the courses here in America compared to Australia. What's your favorite course you've played on anywhere across the world?
Oh, that is a tough question. I think I am biased to courses at home. I think growing up there, and I absolutely adore my home club, Glenelg Golf Club, and it's like my happy place. I go there and I just feel comfortable, and all the members are so kind. And yeah, I'm very lucky. But in America, I played TPC Tampa Bay my freshman year, and that was pretty cool. Lots of alligators, which was the first time I'd seen them, so that was pretty cool.
Do you ever see any like wildlife in the course in Australia too?
Yeah, one of the courses I play has a resident fox. It just kind of wanders, which is kind of fun. And then a lot of kangaroos and koalas. So, pretty awesome.
That does sound pretty cool. When you have a less than desirable shot or an outcome on the course, how do you mentally put yourself past that and just focus on the next one?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's been a long, long winding road for me. I've had my ups and downs with the mental side of golf. But I think it's just realizing that any anger you hold or like resentment of that shot isn't going to help you. The most important shot is the next shot you're about to play. So I just try to focus on that.
And so do you have a pre-round routine that you do, like a kind of like a superstition maybe that you do before every round you go out there?
Not so much a superstition, but just like sticking to my processes. So I'll always start on the range, and I have certain clubs that I go through, kind of skipping a few and going to like the important ones. And then I end up on the putting green, just doing some drills on there. And also just trying to kind of laugh and joke with my teammates before I go out, trying to just relax and not be too stressed.
So you talking about like laughing and joking with your teammates, when you guys are competing, do you try to keep it light? When you're on the course, just try to keep spirits up?
It's hard because we don't see our teammates once we're out on course, because obviously we're playing in different groups and you have no idea what they're doing. And I'm not sure how much you know about how college golf works, but 4 out of the 5 scores count. So you just have to like believe that your score is going to be the one that's going to count. So I think we try and wave at each other across fairways. So if we do see each other, we'll try and just say hello. But I really like talking to my playing partners and getting to know them, because I mean, we get to meet people from all over the world. So I just try and like make conversation and focus on other things than golf when I'm not at the shot.
Is it ever awkward if you're playing with somebody who just doesn't want to talk, or they're super in their head and you're just trying to make conversation and they're just shutting you out?
Extremely. I'm an extrovert, so I just love to talk. And when people don't want to, I'm like, now I have to talk to myself. Like, this is weird. But most people are pretty good. And you kind of can tell, like, if someone's playing bad, you do kind of step away a little bit and let them do their own thing. And because I know I appreciate that when I'm not doing well. So we kind of just know how to read each other at this point.
And so what you said, we're only 4 of the 5 scores count. You know, how is that where you're competing against your opposing schools, but also kind of competing against your teammates? How's that mindset then as well?
At tournaments, it's not bad, but like, obviously we have to qualify for those 5 spots. We have 10 on our team right now, and you have to, qualify. It's hard being an individual sport because obviously you are thinking about yourself. And I think the most important thing is to realize that you can't do well as a team without each other. Like, at the end of the day, we are competing as a team, and we are wanting, the score, like, to win as a team. Like, sure, if you get an individual win, that's great, but if your team doesn't do well, it still doesn't feel like you've accomplished much. So yeah.
Do you think that golf is more mentally challenging or mechanically challenging, like your swing?
Mentally. Like, you can go into a tournament with like the best form you've had, but if you don't have a good mental game, it can just go out the window. I think, yeah, they always say it's a game that's like, it's of 6 inches, it's just between your head. So yeah.
So what is a tip or two that you have to an amateur golfer like us, yeah,
who I need some help.
I like going out on the course, but through 9 holes I'm gonna shoot 20 over par and get super frustrated with myself. So are there tips about the mental aspect of the game that can translate to my below average game?
That's a tough one. I mean, I would just say have fun, which I mean, I imagine you're doing that anyway. I just, even at my level, I just try not to take it too seriously, because at the end of the day, like, yes, I play at high level, but it's just a game and there's so much more to life. And that's where I try not to let it kind of affect my emotions too much, because at the end of the day, like, I'm going to be fine if I play bad. Obviously I want to play well and I'd much rather play well. But yeah, I'd say just have fun and especially go out there with people you enjoy being around, and then the score doesn't really matter, does it? If it's a nice day and you're out there playing.
And so are you, being a collegiate golfer, do you still ever go out to golf just for leisure and just for fun? Or is it all when you're on the course, it's all competition?
Not so much during season. It is hard, but sometimes we will. We'll just go and like have a hit, play two balls, just to kind of be stupid. But in season, it's hard to not go out there and focus on mechanics and doing exactly what you need to play well. So definitely in off season I do. And when I go home, when I catch up with like mates from home, I definitely just have fun.
Have you had any family or friends come visit or see you play here in America?
Not on the mainland, but we got to play a tournament in Hawaii about a year and a half ago. And obviously that's the closest I would ever play to home. So my mom actually made a holiday out of it and came to watch me, which was so special having her come see. So yeah, that's it.
So growing up, what got you into golf? Did you play other sports as a kid, or was there always something about golf that drew you towards it and then that led you to where you are now?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in like the country, and I just tried every single sport under the sun. It was kind of just what you did, and I stuck to golf, and I absolutely loved it. And I guess I had a bit of a natural talent for it. I did play other sports probably up until about grade 9, and that's when I decided to just focus on golf.
So how many rounds of golf do you think you play in a year?
Oh gosh,
it's probably got to be maybe 1,000.
Yeah, it'd have to be hundreds.
Yeah.
And like, especially when you put together like the 9s that I play at practice as well, if you like add them up, yeah, there's mm-hmm. there's a lot. Yeah. Not enough to get sick of it though, which is good.
Yeah.
So with the extra year of eligibility that all NCAA athletes have, are you going to use that and come back, or is this your true senior year and you're done?
This is my true senior year and I'm going to leave. I'm going to PT school back at home. So I think I'm ready to start the next chapter of my life and go into my career. And also 4 years away from home is a long time. I think I'm ready to be with my family again. And I miss my dog a lot. I think that's really hard. But yeah, no, I think I'm ready. And I've had such a great senior year, like golf wise, like I've been playing so well. So it'd be nice to kind of go out on a high.
And so that kind of comes into this next question, but what are your plans for after you graduate? You said you're going back home to attend PT school. And so is that the main goal?
Yeah, I'm not really sure what I'm going to do with golf. I think I'll probably have a bit of a break to start with and then just kind of play casually and just for fun. But yeah, so the plan is our school year runs March through November. It's like the calendar year instead of over here. So I'm going to have probably around 8 months off, try and get a job, and then yeah, go to PT school.
This is Steph Jankowicz from Redbird Volleyball, and you're listening to The Red Zone on 103.3 WZND.
Welcome back to The Red Zone. We have starters Joey Dwyer and Joe Penny. We're now joined by the pride and joy of Harry Groh.
Oh, yeah.
He's here to talk about some Redbird Volleyball. Mikey, first things first, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, boys. I'm busy typing AirPods into Twitter right now and tagging WZND I can win Joey's AirPods.
Unfortunately, I was bluffing a little bit. If you work here, you cannot win the AirPods. Sorry, gentlemen, yeah. You are all out of
Tell your mom or dad to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then happy birthday.
Yeah. But so, Mikey, you've done great work all season covering the Redbird
like
volleyball
every game.
Team for the Vedette. And so you've gotten to see this team through their highs and lows. Unfortunately, their season came to an end yesterday.
Yeah.
Where do you want to start talking about with this team?
Well, first and foremost, they really had a great season. You can't go without saying that they were great. I mean, they won conference again. They won the regular season and the tournament. And that's something they had not done throughout these Fab Five seniors' tenure. And then yesterday, their season did come to a close, though, however, against UNLV. Mariana Hayden on UNLV was electric. She had 17 kills. She looked great. She really tore through the Redbird defense, and they really came back in that set three, making a couple adjustments, and the seniors especially kind of showed up, but it was too little too late as they fell 3-1.
And I think, you know, watching those matches, or the match yesterday, the sets, it seemed like the UNLV always got off to the better start, but the Redbirds kept fighting back, and you saw that where it seemed like, you know, whenever they were down at their most, it was the seniors that stepped up you know, to the highest level. So I thought that was really special to see how much that group did not want to go out on that note. Unfortunately, it came up short at the end, but they really didn't go down without a fight. I also thought Sarah Kushner had an awesome game, that she's just gotten so much better as the season's gone on, that she's going to be a force to be reckoned with.
She is going to be I might just say she's going to be the best player on the team next year. Yeah, she's going to be there every game out there. She's looking great, and she's only a sophomore. And you could see Steph Jankiewicz was really passionate about the game last night, especially in that third set when they were starting to come back. As she walked off to the bench, she was, you know, cheering on her teammates especially, and she was really into it as out of all those seniors.
And I feel like they changed the lineup. They were, like, rotating a lot of people in. Not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Tamara Otene. Okay, yeah. She came in there, and I feel like she didn't play as much as...
They were saying on the broadcast she'd only played in, like, six games.
She only played in 11 sets played, I believe.
Some health things going on earlier in the season. It was some sickness and stuff like that, as Coach Johnson would call it. But she stepped up when she came in. You're right, Joe. She had three kills in a row, I think, actually, in that second set.
Mm-hmm. And something like that's almost kind of throws a wrench into UNLV, because you watch so much film on the team to do some prep, and then somebody you haven't really seen in that film comes in that kind of is something you are unprepared for, a different skill set that you didn't see forecasted.
Yeah.
And I was watching the game yesterday, and something that struck me, and we were talking about it a little bit, was I don't think I've ever seen a Redbirds volleyball team look so flat out of the gate.
Yeah.
It looked like they really weren't ready for what UNLV was kind of throwing at them, and it took me by surprise. And then you're right, once they got later into the game, especially in the third and fourth set, they really looked like the same team. But by the time they got to the fourth set, it was just a little too late.
And UNLV, one of the best serving teams in the nation, like,
oh my god,
like coming, like, you literally saw, you said, like, they came out like firing, and like they literally did come out firing, like, because they were firing in shots with one of the best service in the entire country. So definitely hard to get two off a good start against that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's something to really take into account, because in our group meet, the WZND Sports one, everybody was saying the first team to 15 points is going to win the set. Mm-hmm. And I think the fact that they were so good on serving, UNLV was, and that they were starting each match by serving, or set by serving, that put them in such a better position, that the Redbirds were just playing catch-up the whole match, really.
And they were never good all season long when they were playing catch-up. Like Joey said, when they got out to a good start, they were dominant. And I would say oftentimes in my stories, the Redbirds came out soaring, is always what I would say, because that's what they would do. They would come out and just prove that they were the best team in the conference. But when you get to the best teams in the country, sometimes it proves that there's always a better team.
And so let's talk a little bit about the season, Mikey, because it really wasn't, you know, a seamless season. There was a lot of, you know, controversy or... You know, a lot of problems they had.
At the
where
beginning,
they had COVID, injuries. Right. There was some dispute over where they really worthy of being the regular season champion, because they played less games than any team in the Valley. So how do you feel this season went? Because this was your first season ever on a beat.
Yeah.
So, and you really got a season like no other to cover.
And just like all sports in Illinois State this year, COVID has really affected all these teams in their seasons, and they don't usually even play in the spring. So this is different for them from the get-go. But like you said, they had a couple games where they were missing players. They had that stretch of 4 weeks late in the season where they didn't get to play UNI or Loyola, didn't get to go travel to play them, which Loyola especially apparently was upset about that, because that's who the team they played in the championship.
Yeah.
So the Loyola coach was upset about the Redbirds getting the regular season title and the one seed in the tournament.
And, you know, that's where I think where it speaks to even more how special this season was, that they were able to win the regular season, win the Valley, with everything they had go wrong for them this season. You know, they could have had a bad season, lost in the first game of the tournament. Everyone said, well, you know, COVID, well, injuries. But they didn't let any excuses be the undoing of their season. They really just overcame any obstacle that was on their path.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they, before that four-week stretch where they didn't have any games, I mean, they had five games postponed during that stretch. And the game before that, they blew a 2-0 lead to Valparaiso.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and then they went on a 9-game win streak, including the conference tournament. So that was impressive.
Yeah, like, because as you were saying, that four of their six wins were in their first eight games, and then after that, everything got canceled. So it's like you had to build up certain type of thing, and even with that certain stretch they were not playing, maybe it was just a time where they could just kind of take a step back slowly and maybe get more relaxed and get more into like a mental stage. And you saw that right out of the gates against Missouri State. They came out strong after those games back, and it was just a great year. They have everything to be excited about, especially looking forward to next year too.
And before that COVID break, they were consistently winning the first game of a two-game series and then dropping the second one. I think they did that like four or five out of their first five or six matchups of the year. And then, like Mikey said, off that COVID break, they won everything. I think that was a good reset for the team because of the early struggles that they had had. They were missing Steph, Kaylee Martin, Sydney Holt, so they were able to get the entire team healthy and really hit the ground running.
And yeah, like looking back at the schedule in these last games, like none of these games are really close. Like they won their sets 3-0, 3-0, 3-0, or 3-1. Like no other team won two sets until they met UNLV in the NCAA tournament since since February 22nd was the last time a team won two or more sets before last night.
And that's crazy. And I remember we talked to Sarah Kushner earlier in the season. She talked about the back-to-back matchups in the Valley, that how tough it was, how physically demanding it was playing in those second games. So I think it took them all season to get used to that too.
Yeah.
But Mikey, looking back at some of the players this season, who would you say was the MVP of the Redbird volleyball team this season? Who impressed you the most?
I mean, you could say a ton of different people. But I'm going to go with Kaylee Martin, especially because Steph Jankiewicz said it herself in a press conference recently. She has seen improvement from Kaylee. She wasn't a consistent starter in the year before. She played a lot, but she became a consistent starter and arguably the best player on the entire team. She was vicious from the back row. She would fly high through the air and get 15 kills a game. I mean, last night, Mariana Hayden had 17 kills and Martin had 14, and it's rare that somebody topped her for more kills in the match.
Yeah, I mean, she's been just such a dominant force all season. And I think that this was only her second year as a Redbird after she transferred in from Northern Illinois. She's been such a welcome addition to this team. But moving forward, they're losing the Fab Five seniors. That's going to be tough to replace. But I thought Coach Johnson did a good job of implementing some younger players to the lineup this year. Who are some players that we should be excited for next season, for the 2021 fall season?
Yeah, and we talked already about Sarah Kushner. She'll definitely still be around. We didn't talk at all about Nora Janka yet, who is a setter who was following Steph Jankiewicz all year. And if there's someone you can follow and follow the footsteps of, that's Steph Jankiewicz. And when Steph was out, it was that Indiana State series when Steph was out for a couple games, Nora stepped up, and she did do really well in that first game win, that 3-2 win against Indiana State on February 7th.
Also, another player who looks really good is Katie Weimer-Skirch.
Yeah.
She's a great player if you're looking for a good serve. I thought she did an excellent job in the game yesterday. I saw her out there a lot. She was getting a lot of good digs and sacrificing the body, and so I think she could be a good role player to kind of step up on this team as well.
I think also we forgot the Rochester duo of Nicole Lund and Caitlin Prodzinski. Yeah. They both, one was a freshman, one was a sophomore, but they were both young and got a lot of experience as the season went on, and they were just a force to be reckoned with in that front row, just being able to get those blocks and those kills, so they're going to take on an even bigger role next year, too.
And they'll get three more years together, because Lund was a redshirt freshman last year, too, because she got an injury like really early on, so she didn't even play a game at Redbird Arena in 2019. So she played her first Redbird Arena games this year, and they, like our own Jake Fogle wrote, they are a duo from Rochester, like you said, and they are a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and like even everyone gets an extra year now too with the COVID year. So I mean, maybe some seniors will be coming back. They haven't said anything about it. We were kind of talking about it earlier, so it's something we'll kind of just have to see. But with Sarah Kushner, she can do literally everything. She can serve, she can attack, and then she could she does well with digs and even blocks up there. She might not be the tallest compared to some other people on the court, but she's got the hops and she can close out games too. I remember I was watching, I think it was during the conference tournament where she ended the game.
The championship.
Yeah,
I guess.
Conference championship. She ended.
She was the closer there. Uh-huh. And that's something, we're taking into account that this is Coach Johnson. She's still getting, her first full classes of players she
it's
recruited.
It's crazy to think about.
So she's kind of still resetting this program while contending with players she inherited. So it'll be interesting to see who chooses to stay here because she's built such an impressive culture already in just a few short years.
That's what I was going to say. The expectation of the program has just gone crazy in the last couple of years under Coach Johnson. I mean, the fact that we're disappointed in them not winning in the national tournament is insane, because before even making the national tournament, was such a reach.
Yeah, so they're not going to rest on that.
Yeah, I feel like now the question isn't going to be, are they going to make the tournament? I think the now question is going to be, are they going to win the first round? I think that they're just going to keep on getting there, because even when they don't win the conference tournament, they were still able to make it in to 2 years ago.
Yeah, and I think this program is just going to continue getting more respect, too. And another thing to consider, you're going to have players that have 2-3 years of tournament experience on that roster, too. So even though they haven't got that win, they know what it takes to get there. They know what it takes to play in those games. And you got to think they're sick and tired of losing in those games. So they're going to be a much more experienced team next year, even though they might be losing a lot of their key players.
Yeah, I think the moral of the entire story is that regardless of who is leaving this team, they're so stacked on the bench and on that back end that they're going to be very formidable in the Missouri Valley Conference for years to come.
So, Mike, before we go to the break, you got any bold predictions for next season? What do you think about the 2021 fall Redbird volleyball season?
Back to back to back.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I love that. Champions. I love that.
And it's crazy to think how it is in the fall. Like, they're going to be playing these two seasons
in
such a short rest. Yeah, so, I mean, we're going to have to keep an eye on that, as long as some other sports, too.
Yeah, who knows what that's going to be like. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to let Mikey stick around. We're going to talk some MLB action. You're listening to Red Zone on 103.3 WCND, the Pulse of Redbird Nation.
This is Illinois State infielder Owen Miller, and you're listening to The Red Zone on 103.3 WZND.
We're back on The Red Zone. Leo Stoddard, Joey Wire, Joe Kennedy, and Mikey Fornelli here. Mikey, in addition to being a Redbird volleyball expert, is a huge Chicago Cubs fan, so we won't hold that against him. So, Mikey, because we're just such nice guys, we're going to let you talk about the Cubs, even though there's tons of White Sox stuff to get to, because, like I said, Joey and I are just such nice guys.
We are, Leo.
And they
forget
that I'm still a Cubs
fan. Right, we got a little bit of a two-on-two here.
Okay, Leo, we are just such nice guys.
They're not, though.
This is why Sox fans are objectively better, because they would never give us this opportunity.
This is all they want to talk about on air. Off air, it's a completely different story.
All right, Mike, let's get into it. Tell us a little bit about where you're feeling with this Cubs team, because it's early, but it's still a lot of the same problems. So where's your temperature at right now with the Cubs?
And Joe, we were making jokes about how they're only one game behind the White Sox and all that stuff, but they're still not doing well.
I know. I mean, to get them rallied.
Right. 5-7, they don't look good so far. Dropped a couple really easy games against the Pirates, Brewers. And I want to talk specifically about Javi Baez, because is slugging .422. He has 3 home runs, and that the slug is second on the team behind Chris Bryant, and he is tied for the lead in home runs with Chris Bryant. But he still has 21 strikeouts on only 45 at-bats.
He's looking like the former Javi.
Yeah,
he
has lost the touch with hitting. He's going through something right now.
And it's tough to look at, too. I mean, you were saying that he's had a couple good games against the Brewers. He had a good game in there with that home run and everything. But if you take a look at the infield, how a couple of years ago it looked like Javier Baez, Ben Zobrist, Addison Russell, even Gleyber Torres, and now it's basically just Javier Baez now there, and that depth is just gone there and in that position, too.
And, I mean, you talked about the boom or bust potential from the Cubs. I think that's something that's a prevalent theme with the whole team is, you know, they can hit the ball out of the park, but then it's the contact again. Just looking at Fangraphs, they're last in the league in on-base percentage, in batting average, and strikeout rate. So when they are hitting the ball, they're putting it out of the park, but they're not doing it enough times to get on base and increase those chances of scoring runs.
That's been the issue for years. I think of that 2018 Game 163 / Wild Card Series where they had those 2 losses in a row at Wrigley Field. And ever since then, they have not been able to get contact-based hits, as Leo said, because it's not hitting. They can hit home runs. It's contact-based hits.
And that comes down to roster construction with me is, so you know what you have in Baez, Bryant, Contreras, Rizzo, and formerly Schwarber. But instead, you're surrounding them with players that also hit like them. Peterson's doing the same thing. Jock Peterson is. You had a guy like Castellanos, who I thought did a good job of mixing contact and power, but they let him walk. So where does that come down to? Is it an organizational philosophy, or are these guys just cursed when they put on the blue pinstripes?
It's basically like you guys have a team full of Adam Dunns out there.
Yeah.
The guys who it's really like a 3 true outcomes hitter every time
were hitters before too. Like they were able to have that in that World Series team years even before that, even the year after too. A little like this team was able to get on contact. This team was able to get on base. And you got to think, is it the hitting? Is it how their hitting coach is talking about it and everything?
Or they've had so many different hitting coaches. I wonder if it comes the players have turned off the message. They're not open to change. I mean,
and it's just hard. What do you do to fix it? I mean, like the season started, it's like, what are you gonna do to fix it? It's like, it's just like you can't really do a lot.
I don't know. That's like, why I think if you were the Cubs, you'd want to bring in more guys that hit opposite ways of them. And Ian Happ's kind of done a nice job of doing that. I think he's, you know, more similar to like Castellanos than to Bryant and all them. I think he's a bright spot on this team. And even Eric Sogard, I know he's not great, but he does hit a 92% contact rate over his career. So that's, he's just not very good in general. But if you bring in more players like that to complement the players you have that you know have the power but not the contact, I think this team might be structured better.
And I think you can make some comparisons to Eric Sogard at his best to Ben Zobrist, but I also think you can look at Jock Peterson, who's brought in to be kind of like the new Kyle Schwarber, I guess you could say.
Had a lot of hype, too, in the spring training and everything.
Spring training, he's a boomer bust hitter. Yeah. You know, he had 25, 26 home run seasons, 2015, 2016. And now he's second on the team in strikeouts at 15 early on behind Baez. The guys who you think are going to go up there and get consistent base hits, consistent home runs, are not showing up through the first 2 weeks.
The one thing, though, that has been pretty well, though, I would say, is the pitching. I feel like they've gotten good debuts out of their starting, too, especially with Arrieta yesterday, though, not so much. But in the previous game, he's been looking well. And in their bullpen,
it goes down more back to roster construction. We were talking about it with
We talked about it like last week, too.
Well, I was saying with Red Bird baseball, how they don't have much velocity coming out of the pen.
Yeah.
I'd say Kimbrel's probably the hardest throwing reliever they have. Would you guys say that's fair?
Yeah, easily.
And then they
probably bring
in lots of other relievers that don't throw hard, that throw for contact, and you have lots of contact starting pitchers, so it's not much of a change from your starter to your bullpen. Your relievers are more similar to your starters, so it doesn't catch batters off guard. They're able to just keep staying in rhythm the whole game. So that's what's concerned me a little bit about the Cubs' bullpen roster construction. But I do say I like the idea of Zach Davies, the starter they got from San Diego for Yu Darvish. I think he's like a Kyle Hendricks light, where they were breaking down his pitching on 6-7 The Score, and they were saying that, you know, he does throw a lot of fastballs, even though he doesn't throw the ball hard, but he's one of those guys where he throws such good off-speed stuff that he throws his fastball for strikes because hitters don't see it coming, and it just kind of works, even though he's not throwing it hard.
I've already seen, like, articles written about potential trade pieces, and Zach Davies is already one of them top of the list. And, I mean, right now, like, out of the players you could get your bang for your buck, I mean, Zach Davies might be up there.
And Jed Hoyer was like, they asked him, they're like, is it, you know, should we start talking about the trade deadline, stuff like that? He's like, no, we shouldn't start talking about the trade deadline.
Still a long ways to go.
Pretty early.
I mean,
it's
atrocious offense.
It's a long
ways
to go, but also you're seeing the same problems you've had the last couple years.
Right,
so
that's the problem.
Where does that come from? Is that coaching or is that management?
I think it's literally everything. Like, I mean, it's like the players, how they're thinking, and it's because it can't just be one thing or how it happens for so long. Otherwise, they would be able to find at least something and try to fix it, because I feel like they've tried to fix certain things in everything we've just talked about, like managing, their pitching control, their front office, and everything. Like, I think it just has to come down to, I mean, a little bit of everything.
Exactly. And it's, like you said, it's a player thing, because they've gone through so many different hitting coaches. They went from Joe Maddon to David Ross. They did all these things to try and change the issue, and they're still having the same issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do you go from here with this core? I mean, who do you keep? Who do you?
I don't know. It's just
before the season, I would have said Baez, but if he doesn't flip something around in the next couple weeks, I don't know.
Because I feel like the Cubs aren't going to get a lot of offers from teams that they're going to like, and then at the end of the day, some of these guys are just going to walk for free in the offseason.
Yeah, you have to think none of these guys have much value at the current moment.
Yeah.
Chris Bryant's represented by Scott Boris. He's going to get
some
money. Yeah. He's going to go to whatever team wants to give him so much money. It doesn't even matter if it's Seattle Mariners. He's going to go play for a team. I mean, something tells me he'll go play in Philly.
No,
with Bryce Harper.
Play with his guy.
Yeah, Philly can pay him.
San Diego somehow.
San Diego.
Or
maybe I could even see the Angels. I know a lot of Cubs consider going to the Angels. Wilson Contreras.
How's his relationship with Maddon?
I think they all had great relationships with Maddon. Especially Wilson Contreras and Javi Baez, who Baez is going to be a free agent.
I mean, because, you know, we saw Dexter Fowler got traded to the Angels this offseason. He tore his ACL, though. Yeah. Did you guys see who they signed to replace him? John Jay, another former manager. Yeah. All these guys want to go back there and play for Joe. I find that just kind of speaks to what a good manager he is.
John Jay has been everywhere, though.
John Jay's had every manager in the league.
Yeah, right? He was on the Sox.
That he was willing to go sign up for another year at Joe Madden, that he respects him that much.
Right.
All right.
So speaking of the White Sox, best outfielder of all time, John Jay.
Adam Eaton.
Let's move to the White Sox.
Did they play a game last night? Did they do something cool?
I think they did, and I think Carlos Rodon threw a no-hitter, the second in 2 years for the franchise.
That was pretty cool.
I love the White Sox, and I was a Tony La Russa hater coming into the year, and now I'm a Tony La Russa mild disliker. I can appreciate some of the things that he does.
Yeah.
And the situation that he's in. I still don't think he's the best fit for the team. However, the Sox have looked okay under him. And I am hopeful that they'll rebound from this slow start.
I mean, first, I think we should just talk about the Carlos Rodon no-hitter, because what a cool story that was. We were talking about college coaches overusing their star pitchers and ruining them for the majors. Carlos Rodon was that.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Second overall pick? Right?
Yeah, but NC State, they just worked him to death in the College World Series. So his arm was flat by the time he hit the minor leagues. He's had so many surgeries. He only had, like, 9 appearances last year. He's been through so much for this team, been labeled as a bust. So it was so cool to get to see him, you know, enshrine himself in baseball glory last night and get that no-hitter. You know, because who knows what he's going to be. I was negative about him going into the season as the fifth starter. We don't know what he's going to be, but he will always have this moment and will be cemented in White Sox lore, which is pretty cool.
And it reminds me of, like, Alec Mills' no-hitter last year, too. It's like, oh, I mean, look at this guy. He can pitch.
Thing about baseball where something historic could happen on any given night, a random Wednesday night in April.
And it kind of reminds you of Lucas Giolito last year, coming out of a couple bad seasons, a couple surgeries, and then coming out and I think Lucas Giolito in 2019 looked a lot better. I got to see him pitch live in 2019, and he looked better then. But then 2020 had a no-hitter, and he's looked good since then.
Yeah, Giolito has been such a rock for this rotation the past 2 years. And he was a guy who, like you said, he did not start off his career very well. And I found it very easy to be negative about Lucas Giolito and Carlos Rodon and all these guys on the Sox rotation 3 years ago.
Well, the thing about Giolito, how he rehabbed was he wasn't working with Don Cooper, the White Sox pitching coach. He called up his Harvard Westlake High School baseball coach, Ethan Katz, to work with him in the offseason. And now who's the coach of the White Sox pitching staff? Yeah. Ethan Katz. So he got to work some of his magic on Carlos Rodon here, too. So I think that speaks so much. This guy fixed Giolito so well that it got him a job in the majors.
And he's got three of the best starting pitchers, too, he coached in high school.
He coached Flaherty.
Yeah, Freed.
So he's just an insane coach, and now he's going to do his work in the majors. So that's something that I think is pretty exciting. But, I mean, guys, it was... I can't talk about this no-hitter without talking about that Jose Abreu play in the bottom of the ninth to save
this
it.
He is what you want as, like, the leader of your team in the dugout. I love Jose Abreu so much.
Mm-hmm. And he's been through it all, too. Especially.
He has.
Like,
he's been through when they were decent.
He's
and then,
the Rizzo of the Cubs. Yeah. If they're going to go win the World Series, Jose Abreu
is
their
guy.
He really
is.
He was on the team when it was Chris Sale and nobody else.
Yeah.
And now it's everybody that we could ever ask for. And so he really deserves it, and he deserves his AL MVP. And I just love Jose Abreu so much. And this whole team, that week, Tim Anderson came back. Even the outfield situation is absolving itself at least a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's still some issues, but Adam Eaton has proved that he can still play. Andrew Vaughn has looked serviceable in left, which is promising.
Put him on the bench. That's the thing that's more frustrating.
How do you feel about Adam Eaton, especially after today's little sequence where he kind of got into a little benches
cleared? A little stubborn.
I always hear like different views on Adam Eaton. Like, a lot of Sox fans either love him, hate him, or like, they're just, oh yeah, he's just all right.
I mean, he's Adam Eaton.
He's a high energy guy.
What's he eating?
I think, you know, he just can be destructive in the clubhouse. We heard that about him in Washington. Heard about him in 2016, how he was just butting heads with Todd Frazier. What did he say? He threatened to crack his skull open. Like, I think he's just, when he makes himself the alpha in the locker room, he's kind of dangerous. But I think there's already so many well-respected established leaders on this team that he's not going to try to challenge Abreu or Anderson or Giolito. So I think he kind of fades in the background. And as a depth player, I'm fine with him. I still think, you know, he's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, but sometimes you need those crazy guys on your team, you know? You got to keep the thing going. You got to get
that
one
guy. I mean, I'd rather have a crazy guy in a fun way rather than a crazy guy in an angry way, though.
Yeah, in a bad, bad way, too.
And, you know, he's like not really the starter in the outfield. If Adam Engel and Eloy Jimenez were healthy, he would not have a starting role in this team.
Trade deadline, what are you looking to upgrade at? Outfield?
Right field. Starting pitching.
Okay.
Starting pitching?
I still think add a veteran starter because you still...
Depends.
Keuchel's been banged up the past 2 years. Lynn,
They're pretty old.
Cease... he's sick, but also Dylan Cease has struggled to find the strike zone. I think one more veteran pitcher going into the playoffs would be huge.
And it never hurts, too. Never hurts.
I think it'd be more important to shore up the right field situation.
I said right field and starting pitching. You can do both. Nah. You know, this isn't a only solo option for Rick Hahn. He can do both, even though he didn't
but
in the offseason.
But, Leo, let's remember, we're talking about Rick Hahn here.
Yeah.
It's pulling teeth to get him to make one move.
So asking for two might be
exactly.
Too much.
So if we were going to do one, I'd rather address the right field problem because we have at least we have a decent enough rotation.
Mm-hmm. I have one quick question.
Okay.
I wanted to go back to Abreu really fast because I saw this on Twitter. Take credit for this. I saw this on Twitter, but I wanted to ask you guys, what do you think was the more meaningful play? Abreu in the ninth inning when it was still a perfect game, because it was still a perfect game at the time, or Dwayne Wise in the barely perfect game?
Dwayne Wise.
Dwayne Wise is that is historic. There's a reason that that man played in the outfield for maybe 2 years, and we all remember it.
Jose Abreu will be remembered for an MVP. He'll be top 10 in home runs with this team. Dwayne Wise was a fifth outfielder, and is they put the catch up on the outfield wall. So I think
and saved his perfect game.
Insane. But that's all the time we have for the show. We'd like to thank Emma Sutton for coming on, Mikey Fornelli making his Red Zone debut. It was a great show. If you missed any part of tonight's show, you can catch it on WZND.com. I'm Leo Stoddard for Joe Kennedy, Joey Dwyer, Mikey Fornelli, and Emma Sutton. We thank you for listening. Have a great weekend, everybody.
To hear this and other past episodes of The Red Zone again, download the Red Zone podcast online at WZND.com or on iTunes. And, of course, tune into The Red Zone every Thursday at 6, right here on 103.3 WZND.
The Pulse of Redbird Nation.